That's right. It's happy days. It's Thursday afternoon, the day after Secretary Clinton testified in front of the House and the Senate. And today on the air with us, who do we have but Congressman Jeff Duncan. How are you doing today, Congressman Jeff Duncan?
And I'm doing great. Thank you so much for having me on the program.
Absolutely. Well, I tell you what, I saw you on TV yesterday. I know that it was a, tell us a little bit about the experience.
Well, it was a long-awaited and anticipated opportunity to ask questions of Secretary Clinton. The last time she was in front of our committee, I was such a junior member of that committee. By the time it got around to me, actually, the person right before me was the last one to be able to ask her a question. She had to leave at a certain time, so I missed that opportunity after sitting there for so long. But yesterday, of course, I've moved up in seniority on that committee. I'm 11 spots or 10 spots away from the chairman. And so after about, an hour, it came around to me, and I sat there and sort of disappointed at the other Republican members ahead of me of not asking her the real pointed and tough questions about what went on in Benghazi and using her words against her in some ways. And so I had the opportunity to. I seized upon that opportunity. I feel good about the questions or the line of attack that I had, because I believe Americans being misled about what happened in Benghazi. I think there's a lot of unanswered questions, and I'm working on a letter, hopefully with Senator Rand Paul, to our leadership on both chambers, requesting that they appoint a special investigator and let's have a special committee looking at this, because we're not getting anywhere through these normal committee processes.
Well, it just, one of my questions, Jeff, was, is Secretary Clinton now done? Will she be back again, or in her eyes, is she finished with this?
I think she's finished with this. It's winding down. They're having confirmation hearings of Senator Kerry today as the next Secretary of State appointed by President Obama. So I think she's short time. One thing I said yesterday, she kept saying she takes responsibility for what happened in Benghazi, but what does that mean? I know when one of my children mess up and they take responsibility for it, I'm proud of them for taking responsibility, but that doesn't mean that they don't have to pay for what they broke or replace what they broke or be disciplined in some way. And, Secretary Clinton's still in her job, and there are four people at the State Department that have just been reassigned. They're still drawing their salaries and haven't been disciplined at all. We haven't caught the perpetrators, the ones that killed the ambassador and the other brave Americans there, especially the two Navy SEALs that gave their lives trying to protect others. And so, doggone it, America wants to see some action here. In fact, Leon Panetta had harsher words over the weekend about working with our allies to bring the culprits to justice that killed Americans at the gas plant in Algeria. Harsher words about that than he's had or anyone's really had about bringing to justice the al-Qaeda operatives that killed the ambassador and stormed our special mission there in Benghazi. And so, the question I asked yesterday, Ann, was if Chris Stevens, the ambassador, knew the volatile situation in Benghazi and the memos and the cables point to the fact where he requested more security and it was denied, but he still went to Benghazi. Why did he go? What was the purpose that was driving him to go into a volatile situation where he knew al-Qaeda was present? There were flags all over. What was he doing? He went to meet with a Turkish ambassador, we understand, but what was that about? What exactly was going on that led him over there and ultimately cost him his life?
Well, I think not only that, Jeff, but then when you throw in about the weapons that where were they going, and there's all that conversation about that, too. It just sounds like it definitely is being covered up in some way, and it just doesn't seem to me like the administration that we're going to get to the bottom of this.
Well, they're definitely hiding something. That's why they rolled Ambassador Rice out to mislead the American people before an election. They wanted the Americans to believe that al-Qaeda was on the run and not rising in influence in North Africa, which they were. They're a large presence, and if you think about it, we had prior to last the spring of 2011, the Arab Spring, they call it, we had governments across the Middle East and North Africa that were friendly to the United States. We had Mubarak in Egypt. He was a quasi-ally, definitely one that had agreed not to, to harm Israel. There was a treaty in place. Now we have the Muslim Brotherhood running that country. We've got Coptic Christians in Egypt that are threatened by the Muslim Brotherhood. They had a fairly safe existence under Mubarak's regime there. We had Gaddafi in Libya, who didn't like the United States, but after we dropped a bomb on his house and killed one of his friends, or one of his nephews, rather, and then after the incident on 9/11 in 2001 in New York, and we said, we're going to go after any country that's harboring terrorism, he backed off. He gave up some of his weapons and other things, and so I'm not saying he was friendly, but at least he was negated to some degree. We see uprisings in Jordan. We see them in Bahrain. We've seen them down in Yemen. We've seen them in Saudi Arabia. We've seen them in other places now in Syria. It's a volatile region now, and what have we done as Americans to try to, I guess, reverse that trend? And what I'm just saying is there's a lot of unanswered questions about where the weapons went, who we gave weapons to in Libya during the Arab Spring, what the SEALs and what Ambassador Stevens were doing in Benghazi with regard to weapons, and maybe directing those weapons that were recovered over to Syria to the rebels there, who were given weapons to, who were in bed with, and why we're in bed with them.
Well, Jeff, it just seems to me that, there's an old phrase, walk softly and carry a big stick. It seems like as our military, we're not walking softly and carrying the big stick. It seems like things are getting away from us, Jeff.
Well, you know, you can't go in with surgical strikes, and you can't prosecute war efforts and other efforts in the way that we're trying to do it, in my opinion. And it's a humbled opinion. I'm not a war fighter. I didn't serve in the military. But I believe that you've got to take, we've got the ability to take the action that's necessary. And not saying we're bullying our way. When we're harmed like we were on 9/11, when we're harmed like we were with four Americans being killed in Benghazi, we should take a different action. We've got the ability with the assets in the region to go in and extract or evacuate or at least try to protect those Americans when they were calling for help. We should have had the smarts to understand that that was a volatile region. I could put my 12-year-old down to read all the unclassified memos leading up to what happened on 9/11, and he would say, looks to me like there's a security situation in eastern Libya. I don't believe I'd have an operation there. I don't believe I'd send the president's own ambassador over there because it doesn't look like it's safe. That's how clear it was, Ann. So America wants to see more answers to these questions. The Americans frustrated. I tried to exhibit some of that frustration yesterday with the secretary. I tried to get her to answer some questions, take responsibility, tell us what that is, tell us what she meant by being clear-eyed, because what I see with her saying in the Senate hearing that they were clear-eyed about the situation in eastern Libya, they were. The information was there, so why did they ignore it? How can you be clear-eyed and ignore the situation and turn around and send people into harm's way like she did?
Absolutely. Now, how did you find Secretary Clinton? She seemed very much in control. I mean, she did break down a couple of times, but she seemed very much in control of what she was going to tell y'all.
Well, she's poised. She's very good. She's a brilliant woman. I've got a lot of respect for her. I think she's been a fairly good Secretary of State. I'm not going to knock her for that, but we've had some hiccups, and this is one of them, where I don't know if she has culpability in what was going on in Benghazi that led to Ambassador Stevens' death, but I do believe that Americans were misled about what was really going on there. And, she was on the other foot. If we had a president, a Republican president and Republican Secretary of State, you would see another Iran-Contra call for from the Democrats. And so we're not out of bounds here saying we want more answers and what exactly was going on. But I think she was very good. I appreciated her emotion when she was talking about the dead bodies being brought back and the families and whatnot. But I've got emotions too. And the people I represent have emotions. She said we should take emotions out of this as we look at this. No, we shouldn't. We should listen to the American people and understand they have emotions in this. And their frustration and anger or emotions that they're exhibiting right now because they're not getting the answers that they want.
Well, I thought her statement about it doesn't really matter what was it, whether it was a terrorist or a few guys walking by, really, it kind of blew me away when she said that.
Blew me away, and I used that in my questioning of her. I said, you know, why it matters is because the Americans feel like they were misled.
Yeah.
Now, we're going to continue talking about the administration and your Ambassador Rice to the UN. We're going to continue talking about how they misled the American people. When you knew, because you said it just a minute ago, that there was a terrorist attack, why were they misled for days, if not weeks on end, about the reason behind the attack, when you knew it was Al-Qaeda, you knew it was terrorism, and we knew the motivation behind it? I believe the motivation behind the president and his staff was political, to mislead the American people right before a very crucial presidential election for them.
Absolutely. Well, let's talk a little bit about, of course, the president did put out right before he was inaugurated his 23 executive orders on gun control. You are, of course, up there, and I know you're a proponent of gun ownership. What are you thinking about what's being put out there, Jeff?
Well, we're still trying to look at his executive orders and see if they have crossed the line in any way. What concerned me is originally when Vice President Biden spoke, threatening to use executive orders to create law and weaken our Second Amendment rights. I don't believe he's done that yet, but he's come right up to the brink of doing it. And, you know, there's a separation of powers in the United States Constitution. I don't want to see him cross that separation of powers. He has executive functions. We have legislative functions. And when he starts trying to make law by executive order or fiat, then go back to the statement that I made when all that was going on. We have a republic, not a dictatorship. He can't do that. And that's when I will challenge him from the separation of powers. And don't trample on any of my constitutional rights, and especially in this situation, don't try to trample on my Second Amendment rights. Blaming the guns or the type firearm that was used in Connecticut or Colorado or anywhere else is like blaming the knife that was used to kill Nicole Brown Simpson. The knife's no more to blame than the weapon, the firearm that was used in those instances. It is the people. The motivation behind a deranged individual and what we know about those individuals and the mental health situation and whatnot ought to be addressed versus trying to limit what Americans can own and what Americans can use to maybe defend themselves or their home, their property, their families, or to defend this nation against any kind of threat, whether that threat is external from an invading foreign country that might come here. And the reason I say that is Japanese didn't come here because they knew there was a gun behind every blade of grass.
Mm-hmm.
Or, as our founders originally envisioned, against a tyrannical government, a government that would try to take away your rights and try to become a dictatorship or throw you in jail or suspend your rights of habeas corpus or your right to a fair trial or being accused or having a trial by your peers or all the things that we appreciate as our constitutional rights. If they start being infringed upon by a tyrannical government, our founding fathers wanted us to have the weapons to push back, just like the Minutemen and the Patriots did April 19th, 1775.
Absolutely. Now, what do you feel about, though, the discussion about assault weapons, the magazine, and are you feeling that we should have security in our schools? How do you feel that should be handled?
Well, I'm not going to support anything that limits any kind of weapons that we have. The Second Amendment doesn't specify that. The Founding Fathers knew that the militiamen, the patriots that left the battlefield, they took the most modern weaponry that they had. We had the most modern weaponry of the day that we had either taken off the British or been supplied by other countries or we had manufactured ourselves during the war effort. They didn't say, oh, you can go home, but you need to leave your modern AR-15 type weapon. You need to leave it here. You can't have that. No, they said, yeah, you can have those guns. In fact, Abraham Lincoln allowed Robert E. Lee and the Confederate soldiers to take their weapons home. So this isn't about the type of firearm. This is about mental health and other things that I think we can have an adult discussion about, background checks for mental health and what the states are doing and that sort of thing. But I'm not going to support that. And look, I just heard today that out in California, some of the police departments are providing AR-15 type weapons, rifles, for their police officers that are resource officers in the school, just so they can have a show of force and protect the children. Whatever we can do to protect the children, and I'm all for. I introduced a bill back in the General Assembly after the Virginia Tech shooting that was known as the Campus Carry Bill, to allow CWP holders in South Carolina to be able to carry on their persons concealed onto school campuses, whether it was colleges or a mom and dad or teacher or whatnot on the public school campuses. CWP holders are 21 years of age or older. They've gone through some training. They're generally the most responsible people out there. And what I'm fearful of is that we don't have resource officers at our elementary schools in South Carolina.
Right.
You know, we have no armed personnel. There are schools in this state, elementary schools, where they're a long ways away from the sheriff's department, and there's no armed personnel, there's no resource officer or whatnot. There's no one, because of the gun-free zone, there's no one on that campus that could have access to a firearm to stop a shooter, an active shooter. And so I think that that's a valid argument for us to have about what we do to protect children in this country.
Absolutely. So now, what else are you going to be working on during this session here? Are there any particular bills or that you want to introduce or you have working?
Well, we're going to reintroduce a few things that we worked on last time, the EXPAND Act, which is an American energy independence push, and, you know, it has Keystone Pipeline. I'm glad to see some movement in that area. We're going to continue to work on American energy independence. I'm going to continue to work on countering the Iranian threat, you know, a bill I got passed and signed into law last year when the Department of State issues their report that comes from that bill, see if there's any follow-up needed there. I was appointed to the chairmanship of the Oversight Subcommittee on the Committee on Homeland Security, so I have an oversight function. I was on that subcommittee last Congress, and now I'm the chairman of that subcommittee. So we're going to have an oversight function of DHS, the Department of Homeland Security, of TSA, airport screeners. We're going to have oversight over the FBI and the Secret Service and counterterrorism and NSA and cybersecurity and what we're doing, and make sure we've got accountability there for expenditures and whether that agency's gotten too big and too cumbersome by bringing in all the sub-agencies under its umbrella. So I'm gonna be a little bit focused on that, and continue to work on natural resources and continue to work on foreign affairs issues. Subcommittees I'm on foreign affairs, Western Hemisphere, and also Europe, Asia, and emerging threats. And as you can imagine, emerging threats from that that area of the world could be very interesting. And so anyway, we've got a plate full. Going forward and always focusing on limited government, free markets, individual liberties, reining in government spending, trying to be smart and about what we do in our budgeting and with debt and deficit spending, and trying to do what we can on this playing field where the opposition, the Democrats, have two players for every one player we have in the arena.
Absolutely. Now, just, let me ask you one more question here. What about, I love this idea, no budget, no pay.
No budget, no pay. I've said all along, ever since I went to Congress, the Senate ought to pass a budget. In fact, last year, Wednesday of last year was the 1,000th day since the Senate had passed a budget. That was the day of the State of the Union.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the 1,000th day. And I created buttons I gave to every member of our Republican conference, big red buttons that said 1,000 days. And I've worn my button numerous times throughout the year, and we've taken a piece of tape and put over it and changed that number as the days change. And today is 1,366 days.
Wow.
Since the United States Senate's passed a budget for our nation. And so what I liked about this bill, although we did put off addressing the debt ceiling, they're going to allow some additional debt to be incurred while we refocus the United States Congress, A, on the Senate passing a budget and getting in front of the American people on the Senate floor and try to justify their spending priorities and their liberal spending patterns. I think that's important. I think it's responsible government
for the Senate to have to pass a budget, and if they don't, they shouldn't be paid because they are not doing their job. We've done our job. And Paul Ryan is committed.
Once sequestration goes into effect, discretionary spending goes from $1,047,000,000,000 down to $974 billion. So from 1047 down to 974. That's a tremendous cut in actual spending. And that's where the RSC budget, that's the exact number the RSC budget was set forth last year. So 974 is a good baseline for spending. He is committed to set our budget at 974. We're committed to hold, if we get to a CR, to hold the continuing resolution at 974 for the remainder of the year. That gives us our spending cuts. Their commitment to keep it there and Paul Ryan's commitment to write the budget at that gives us our cap that we're looking for. We're going to cap spending, discretionary spending, at a very conservative number on discretionary spending. And then we're going to work on real reform, and that's reforming the process of business as usual in Washington by requiring the Senate to actually do some work and pass a budget. So,
absolutely. But, you know, when I was listening to President Obama's inauguration speech, all I heard was more about raising taxes and spending more money. I didn't hear anything about cutting back here, Jeff.
Well, you know, he was a lot of vision, a lot of rhetoric, but very, very light on specifics, and that's how it's been during his campaign. I'm not going to worry about President Obama. We're going to focus on what we can do as Republicans in the House that control the purse strings, at least initially, and how I can have an impact on behalf of the people in the 3rd District to limit that spending, try to cut that spending where we can, limit the size and scope of government, and block any more tax increases on Americans who are struggling right now in this economy just to make ends meet, hold the line. And I hope Republicans can do that in the House. We're the last line of defense.
Absolutely. Well, Congressman Jeff Duncan, thanks so much for calling us. It's always good to talk to you.
Well, Ann, it's great to talk with you. Thanks for following the Benghazi hearing yesterday. A lot of great sound bites from me. It's something we're not going to slow down on, and we're going to keep pressing to find the answers out for the American people. So thanks for doing that. God bless you, and I look forward to being back on the program.
All right. Thanks so much, Jeff. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Pat.